Each time we adore Christ in the Eucharist, our hearts will be united in Him.
Pope Leo XIV speaking to young people at the Jubilee of Youth. His message, one of hope and inspiration. This weekend marks the first 100 days of his pontificate. Experts, scholars, and lay people weigh in on the themes, actions, and tone so far of Leo's papacy.
What really excites me about Pope Leo XIV is how he will further talk and discuss about human dignity.
And comments from you, our viewers, about your impressions of this first pope from the United States. A full program devoted to Pope Leo's first 100 days. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
I'm on a pontifical commission where he was the president. And I have to say, what I saw a year ago when I met him is what you see now. This peaceful serenity about him, and even in his embracing of this new mission that the church and the Lord has given to him, he's done it with great serenity, with great grace.
Archbishop Nelson Perez of Philadelphia with his early impression of the first pope in history from the United States as we mark this weekend the first 100 days of the pontificate of Pope Leo XIV. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. This week, we devote our entire program to an examination of those first 100 days. As we said, Pope Leo XIV was born in the United States, but more broadly, he is seen as being from the Americas because of the vast influence on his priesthood of the many decades he spent as a missionary in Peru. For the next hour, we will talk about how his origins, his education, his priestly experiences, his ability to communicate in many languages, and his personal demeanor are so far shaping the first impressions of his papacy. As for perceptions from the faithful, they are largely enthusiastic and joyful.
Good evening.
If you want a glimpse into Pope Leo XIV's popularity right now, look no further than the reactions at the recent Jubilee of Youth opening mass, when the Holy Father surprised around 100,000 young people with an unexpected appearance in St. Peter's Square.
Jesus tells us, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world.
That appearance followed by even bigger crowds at the Jubilee of Youth's prayer vigil at the Tor Vergata just days later. 1 million young came to hear the Holy Father.
Each time we adore Christ in the Eucharist, our hearts will be united in Him.
100 days since his election, the appeal of the first U.S.-born pope is already evident.
The moment he stepped out on the balcony and I saw him crying, I knew that I loved him so much.
It's just really amazing to be able to hear him speak in a language that I can understand without having to use my little translator app or anything.
Young Catholics aren't the only ones who approve of the new leader of the Catholic Church. According to a recent Gallup poll, 57% of American adults view Pope Leo favorably, compared to just 11% who view him unfavorably and 31% who are not yet familiar with him. He has an overall net favorability score of 46. That's the highest score among all 14 world leaders included in the poll. Leo also stands out as the only world leader viewed positively across party lines. Leo's broad appeal among both of America's political parties makes sense for a leader who has made unity a major priority of his pontificate from day one.
La pace sia con tutti voi.
The Pope's first words, peace be with you. These themes of unity and peace are deeply tied to his spirituality as a member of the Augustinians. The Order of St. Augustine places a special emphasis on community and friendship. His episcopal motto quotes his order's founder in a nod to those themes. In the one Christ, we are one. Courtney Marez, Rome correspondent for our sister news service Catholic News Agency, notes these first months of his pontificate have been quiet and uncontroversial.
It is clear that he's acutely aware of the gravity of his office, the office of Peter, and that he chooses his words carefully.
And the true friendship is always in Jesus Christ, with truth, love, and respect. Y solo en él puede ser feliz y eterna.
Leo's skillful use of language, seamlessly moving from Italian to Spanish to his native English, has also caught the attention of many church watchers as an opportunity to connect a global church.
More than 1.4 billion people in the world speak English as a first or second language. And with the widespread consumption of short-form video content online, the Pope has the potential to speak directly to so many hearts with the gospel. Not to mention his impeccable Spanish, with which he can speak to nearly 500 million people in their mother tongue.
Pontifex in Latin means bridge builder, and our Holy Father is especially emphasizing that role of the Petrine office, aiming to heal divisions not only within our church, but in our world, torn apart by war and polarization. He's spoken with Russian President Vladimir Putin over the phone and has met privately with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Pope Leo has also hosted spiritual leaders from both countries. In May, His Beatitude Sviatoslav Shevchuk, the head of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, and in July, Metropolitan Anthony Sevreyuk, a metropolitan of the Russian Orthodox Church. In his many public audiences, he has continuously asked the faithful to pray for peace in both Ukraine and in Gaza.
I follow with great concern the very serious humanitarian condition in Gaza, where the civilian population is crushed by hunger and continues to be exposed to violence and death. I renew my grieving appeal for a ceasefire, the liberation of the hostages, in the full respect of humanitarian law.
And in a moment of rapidly changing technology, Leo is using his pontificate to warn against the ramifications of artificial intelligence for the human person.
A un'altra rivoluzione industriale e agli sviluppi dell'intelligenza artificiale.
Though the pontificate of Pope Leo has so far revealed the precise, intentional mind of both a mathematician and canon lawyer, it's also revealed the heart of a father, one who loves his ministry and the flock he serves. And his flock is eager to see what he does next.
We're in such a time of so much conflict in the world and so much change, but especially now, because this is the Jubilee of Hope, I know that the Pope is going to bring that hope and help inspire the fire of that hope and to help build that civilization of love.
Pope Leo reaches this milestone as he spends a brief and restful holiday at Castel Gandolfo, a hill town south of Rome that has served as the papal summer residence for centuries. On Friday, Pope Leo celebrated Mass for the Solemnity of the Assumption with residents of Castel Gandolfo. He'll say another Mass later this weekend with a group of impoverished people in a neighboring town. Leo's week-long retreat is his second visit to the papal residence after spending much of July there. His visits this summer revive a long-standing tradition of pontiffs spending their summers in Castel Gandolfo, a custom the late Pope Francis refrained from. After Mass, Pope Leo recited the Angelus from the town's main square, where he prayed for peace.
Gesù non si scandalizza davanti alla nostra fragilità.
Jesus is not scandalized by our fragility. He knows well that no friendship is immune to the risk of betrayal. But Jesus continues to trust, continues to sit at the table with his followers.
Before departing for Castel Gandolfo, Leo gave his latest reflection on the Last Supper, this week speaking on Judas's betrayal of Jesus. He explains salvation begins with the awareness we are capable of breaking God's trust, but we can renew that trust thanks to God's mercy. Due to heat, this general audience was moved from St. Peter's Square to the much smaller Paul VI Audience Hall. Leo greeted the overflow pilgrims who could not fit inside the hall at St. Peter's Basilica following his catechesis. And joining me now in studio to reflect on the first 100 days of Pope Leo XIV are two guests who bring deep insight into the life of the Church. Dr. Susan Timoney is Associate Dean for Graduate Ministerial Studies at the Catholic University of America, where she's also Associate Professor of Practice in Pastoral Studies, specializing in evangelization and pastoral leadership.
Stephen White is executive director of the Catholic Project, which brings together clergy and laity to address the challenges the Catholic Church faces in the U.S. He's a leading commentator on church affairs. Well, thank you both so much for joining me for this special milestone looking at 100 days. It's been 100 days since we saw Pope Leo appear on the loggia, his style coming a bit more into focus now. Susan, how would you summarize briefly his papacy so far?
I think we've had an opportunity to see him in so many diverse situations because it's the Jubilee year and he's greeting so many different kinds of pilgrims. And for me, what stands out is his commitment to wanting to be seen as a shepherd and also to want to really represent the mission of the church.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, your impressions of this first 100 days?
He seems very comfortable in his own skin. He wears the office, I don't want to say lightly, but well, he seems comfortable in his own skin and he doesn't seem to be in too much of a rush. I think he's still figuring out what kind of pope he's going to be, still figuring out what the job means for him and for the church. So I think in addition to being able to see him with all these different pilgrims for the Jubilee, I think he seems very comfortable in the role in a reassuring and edifying way.
Well, on that note, in Jubilee crowds, in his biggest crowd yet, 1 million young people attended the prayer vigil at the Tor Vergata on the outskirts of Rome for the Jubilee of Youth prayer vigil. Take a look at this video our social media team put together to look at those parallel moments of Pope Leo and St. John Paul II when he hosted World Youth Day there in the Jubilee year 2000. Let's talk about the parallels that we're already starting to see between Pope Leo and his papal predecessors so far. Stephen, do you have thoughts on that?
Well, I do. I was in that field in the year 2000. It was quite warm, as I recall. You know, you want to be careful making comparisons to a man who's a canonized saint. But I think there are some similarities in both sort of the ease of personality. I have to confess that there have been a couple times where I've seen a clip or a photo of Leo and sort of out of the corner of my eye I thought it has a similar profile to John Paul II. Mm-hmm. There's something about their carriage and demeanor that I find similar. Beyond that, I think you don't want to draw too many conclusions, but right. I think a pope of continuity, he has that sort of easy charisma and charm that is, helps a man in his office. So,
Susan, do you have thoughts on that? Parallels between recent papal predecessors, even Benedict or Francis?
I think he is able to demonstrate that he's really interested in people. Mm-hmm. And I think he does have an interest in young people. He seems comfortable around young people. He seemed comfortable in the space. And so I think that helps them say, here's someone we want to listen to.
Yeah. You've already hit on this, Stephen, but there are church watchers who have observed he seems at ease in his role. He seems to really enjoy it as well. What do you make of that assessment, and how much does being the ripe young age of 69 contribute to that?
Well, I don't know the man, so it's tough to answer that question. Yeah. I mean, I think there is this ease in the role and holding that office that is good. We've commented on that. Yeah. I think there's also a way in which he is very aware of the office, and perhaps it's the case, I don't know, perhaps it's the case that understanding that the office is bigger than just him, that kind of boundary around what is expected of you and what you can do might, in a way, be liberating. He doesn't have to reinvent the thing, right? He just be yourself within the office that has been laid upon your shoulders, and there's kind of a peace and freedom that can come with that. He seems, whether that's the case with him or not, but he seems, like we said already, to be at ease in his work, which is good.
Susan, you received your doctorate in sacred theology in Rome at the Angelicum, where Pope Leo himself
indeed
is an alumnus. How would you assess his theological approach so far?
I think it's very much coming from the way he understands his responsibility as Pope, mm-hmm. as the Holy Father. So he speaks particularly to the role of the Pope as shepherd. Mm-hmm. He's spoken a lot about his primary emphasis needs to be on unity, so communion and mission. And so you see it very much grounded in the office of the papacy.
Absolutely. 100 days in, there's obviously still a lot we do not yet know about how Pope Leo will govern the church. For example, what actions will he take on Traditionis Custodes? What about the church in Germany, for example? What do you see as the major challenges Pope Leo still has to address, and sooner rather than later? Stephen, I'd like to start with you in case perhaps there is a particular sexual abuse scandal that demands action right now.
Well, there are some high-profile cases that are sort of left over from the previous pontificate, and I'm sure he'll get to those in time. The high-profile case of Father Rupnik comes to mind. Mm-hmm. personnel is policy, and he hasn't made most of his big personnel and curial appointments yet. So we'll see. That will dictate a lot. I think we need to give him time on this. You know, it's more important that he get these decisions right than that he gets it done immediately, especially coming out of the Roman summer, where most of the curia slows down, to put it generously, in the summer. So I think it will be a busy fall, and I think we'll have a much better sort of picture of where the church is going to go under him in the next couple months.
Susan, what immediate challenges does Pope Leo face?
So I would say, obviously, the continuing implementation of the synod, right? Bishops' conferences around the world are being expected to do some implementation of some of those priorities.
Right.
He recently spoke to the coordinators of the synod and said, you know, our emphasis needs to be on communion and participation. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see how he begins to define what he means by that, what he hopes to see will continue. From that work. That's one. The other, I would say, is the appointment of women, the leadership of women in the church. Pope Francis began to make some appointments. It'll be interesting to see how Leo wants to continue that, to raise the profile, in a sense, to recognize the women who are in leadership positions.
I think those are two issues in particular people are watching closely to see what actions he takes. Stephen, when Cardinal Robert Prevost was elected, there were two people in particular who are very busy with media interviews, and those were his two older brothers, Lewis in Florida, John in Chicago. And so while most of his religious life has been spent outside of the U.S., his brothers are this reminder that he does know America all too well still. Our EWTN News Vatican editor, Frank Rocca, he dubbed Pope Leo the quiet American so far. That seems to be his approach. But how much, Stephen, do you expect our Holy Father to be weighing in on U.S. matters, whether it's political or church matters happening here?
Well, I don't expect he'll break much from sort of the way popes usually handle these things. I think he will continue to speak in defense of migrants, in defense of the unborn. He'll generally speak in sort of more general terms. It would be rare for him to intervene or to sort of name a U.S. politician directly, for example. That can happen, but it's rare. And I think it's difficult for a pope to interfere without making things worse. So I think it would be very... he'd be very cautious to do that. And there are a lot better ways for the church to make its presence known and its thoughts known than, you know, sort of straight from the top a lot of times. So I think he'll be circumspect in that.
And he does seem to be so intentional about every action.
Yeah, and being clear and deliberate in what he does say, I think makes it easier for local pastors, and we've got plenty of those here, to do what they need to do and feel that they've got the support of Rome. But you don't necessarily need a direct intervention from the Vatican on everything.
Susan, how does the Pope's command of communication, how can that really contribute to evangelization efforts of the church?
I mean, it'll contribute tremendously anytime people hear someone speaking in their own language. And certainly English and Spanish represent a fair amount of the Catholic world. So the ability to communicate directly, I think the ability to move between languages in this day and age where so many of our communities are multicultural just plays into this idea that this is tremendous unity in the church among a great diversity.
Absolutely. I'm curious what you both think of his use of English at times and his notable not use of English at times. Do you think he's, you know, very wary of not coming off as too American for our global church?
I think he's probably aware of that, but you know, you used the phrase earlier, a quiet American. He is not the stereotypical sort of loud, brash American personality, or at least I think a lot of the world sees that through Hollywood or whatever, and sometimes from real life. He's not that, and so I think he's probably aware of not coming off as the American Pope.
Right.
At the same time, there are a lot of people in the world who speak English who are not Americans, as our Canadian and English and Australian friends are tremendous. So I think, as Susan said, his ability to move sort of effortlessly between these different languages, including the major languages not only of the Curia speaking Italian, but the, you know, English and Spanish being major languages for the Church. I think that just builds on what we've already said. This sort of this ease of personality, his ability to communicate sort of effortlessly and come across as sort of just who he is.
I have less than a minute left with you both, so just final moment with you. What will you be looking out for in the coming months of Pope Leo's pontificate, Susan?
I'll be looking for the way that he defines and talks about mission. Hmm. Mission is so important to him. And I think building on Pope Francis's attention to who we are as missionary disciples, it will be really interesting to see how much he wants to engage people in the life of the church.
And Stephen?
I'll be looking at curial appointments. I mean, that would be interesting to give some sense of where he wants to go, but also just how he grows into the role himself. You know, it's still early for him. He's still figuring out how, what kind of pope he's going to be, and I think as he gets a better sense of that, so will we.
Yeah, absolutely. Stephen, Susan, thank you both so much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And we are just beginning our examination of the first 100 days of Pope Leo on this special edition of EWTN News in Depth. Still ahead, we'll look at how he's the math pope, inspiring youth ready to tackle the challenges of artificial intelligence, and what you, our viewers, have to say about the priest who used to be called Father Bob.
When I see how people gather together to celebrate their faith, I discover myself how much hope there is in the world.
Welcome back to EWTN News in Depth as we continue our special report on the first 100 days of Pope Leo XIV's papacy. As we've heard, much has been said about the deliberate, careful, and meticulous way the Holy Father is approaching the vast responsibilities he faces as he leads the more than 1 billion Catholics around the globe. Could these traits be linked to the very subjects he studied in school? After graduating from St. Augustine Seminary High School, Prevost continued his Augustinian education at Villanova University, where he majored in mathematics. The year he was ordained a priest, he earned a Master of Divinity degree from the Catholic Theological Union and then turned to the precision of canon law, earning a graduate degree and then a doctorate in canon law from the Pontifical College of St. Thomas Aquinas in Rome, known as the Angelicum. He is the first pope to sit on the throne of St. Peter as a math major, which admiring mathematicians say makes perfect sense. Our own reporting in the National Catholic Register reveals math aficionados see a close connection between math training and systematic theology, both of which seek to bring order and coherence. With his interest in science, technology, and math, Pope Leo has earned the title of being a STEM pope. Joining us now to discuss Pope Leo's bent towards STEM is Dr. Daniel Keebler. He is a biology professor at Franciscan University of Steubenville, the vice president of the Society of Catholic Scientists, and the author of a new book called Darwin and Doctrine, which explores the compatibility of evolution and Catholicism. And in full disclosure, Dan and I hosted the Purposeful Lab podcast for 5 seasons together, where we explore the purpose in the universe and in life. Dan continues to host the podcast today. Dan, it is great to see you, especially for this special show. Pope Leo is our first mathematician pope, but this is interesting. The Center for Applied Research in the Apostolate, or CARA, found that about 10% of U.S. candidates for the priesthood who were ordained this spring majored in either math or science. So who knows? There could be future math popes as well. But Dan, in your opinion, how could a math or science background help to equip the priestly ministry?
Yeah, I think it's great. Math is such a window to both the eternal and to creation. You know, so Galileo said, you know, the universe is written in the language of mathematics, and really understanding math helps you understand God's creation, particularly in physics and chemistry, now even more in biology. But also math is sort of this immaterial thing, like numbers are these immaterial realities. So it points towards, you know, this that there is an immaterial reality there. And I think that's why math sort of blends well into philosophy and then into the bigger questions of life. So what are numbers? You know, they are immaterial things that have reality in this world. So I think, you know, as a pope, you know, I think it's a great mix of, you know, having this science background, math background, but at the same time with the theological training, and the math is sort of a bridge between the two, I think.
It's a fascinating combination. And Dan, on the 56th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, Pope Leo visited the Vatican Observatory and spoke with astronaut Buzz Aldrin. It's only been 100 days of Pope Leo, but what do you make of what seems to be a great interest in space and the galaxy so far?
Yeah, I think, again, he has this love of creation and sees how creation and scientific discovery can bring us closer to God. He spoke to the Vatican Observatory Summer School and talked to their students about, the beauty of God's creation. And I think it's putting a lie to this myth that the more you mesh yourself in science and scientific discovery, the less you're going to become a believer. But the more we understand creation, in fact, the order underneath creation, I think, is leading people to God, which is sort of counterintuitive what this myth that people sort of grew up with. And I think it points towards this order and creation and so forth, and particularly staring out at the galaxy, the wonder and awe of brings you to the wonder and awe of God.
That's beautiful. We'll be delving more into Pope Leo and AI more later in the program, but I do want to get your thoughts on the significance of Pope Leo addressing AI head on. From your perspective, what was your reaction when you heard he plans to make addressing AI ramifications a major part of his pontificate?
Yeah, I think that's great because it's one of those big challenges sociologically, what do we do with this new technology? But it also has sort of philosophical consequences. Is what is a human person and what is it about human people that make us different than technology, and he's really concerned. I think I heard a speech talking about how young people are being affected by AI, and really manipulating data is one thing, but humans have this ability that goes beyond that. And so AI just manipulates data, but humans have the ability to recognize the true meaning of life and the purpose and ultimate purpose. And so not relying on AI to tell us that, but that's something we have to discover on our own. AI can tell us a lot of things, can help us with life, but these ultimate meaningful questions, we don't want to lose those and realize these are things that humans still have to grapple with, particularly young people, because they're growing up with this, in their face all the time.
Absolutely. Pope Leo sent a message to an international bioethics summit held earlier this summer in Rome, and he called on participants to favor approaches to science that are always authentically more humane and respectful of the integrity of the human person. And he also called on them to persevere in scientific knowledge at the service of truth and of the common good. Dan, as a Catholic biologist, your thoughts on the importance of those comments for the scientific landscape today?
Yeah, I think it's similar with AI. It's like science has to be service to humanity. It has to be rightly ordered. It can't be put at the top of the totem pole where you have scientism, where science is the master. If we can do it scientifically, we should just go ahead and do it. But he echoes what Pope John Paul II, Pope Benedict have said about science. Has to be at the service of humanity, never becoming its master, and recognize that science is for the good of the human person. And if it helps the human person flourish, it's great. If you use science as a tool to denigrate the human person, and then that's something that we need to be aware of. And so putting science in context, that there's the theological, philosophical, moral, ethical questions of how we use science to build up humanity rather than denigrate it. And again, he's very consistent with what the church has said over the past few decades about science and scientific discovery.
Absolutely. Dan, you are the leading expert on faith and science. In fact, your new book hits on the compatibility of evolution in the Catholic Church. So, Dan, do you foresee Pope Leo leaning into how faith and science do go hand in hand? And how do you think that might draw even more people into the church?
Yeah, I think he will. He has that background that he's able to do that, having an understanding of mathematics and science and appreciation of that. And I really think that is something that this compatibility of faith and science is something that's coming to the forefront. I know the Society of Catholic Scientists that I'm a member of, we do a lot of work in that area. And I think people are open to that message. I think they're starting to realize this idea that science and faith are at odds. It doesn't fully make sense when we see the beauty and the order of creation. And so I think the more we can lean into that, the more I think you can draw young people, particularly young people that like science, into the faith, where they see, hey, no, this actually builds up my faith rather than destroys it. And I think coming from the Pope, I think that's a wonderful message.
Absolutely. Dr. Dan Keebler, it's great to see you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Catherine.
Meantime, later this month, Pope Leo is slated to receive the highest award given by the Augustinian province of St. Thomas of Villanova, which represents Augustinians along the entire east coast of the United States. This year's recipient of the St. Augustine Medal was selected while he was still known as Cardinal Robert Prevost.
now one of the most recognized people on the planet, Pope Leo had been planning to attend the awards ceremony in Philadelphia on August 28th, while combining it with a vacation and some family time back in the States. That was until his unexpected promotion. Within a day or two of becoming Pope, he informed organizers he could no longer be there in person. The event has sold out. It's more than 700 tickets, despite his absence. And Pope Leo has already recorded a greeting to the guests. The St. Augustine Medal is awarded to a person exemplifying the highest qualities of truth, unity, and charity.
Kind of puts into perspective who Pier Giorgio actually was.
Coming up next, walking the way of Frassati. We go on pilgrimage with some young American men who have come to Italy to learn from the example of one of our next saints. Just weeks from now, Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati will be among the first saints canonized by Pope Leo. Reporter Colin Flynn joins their pilgrimage right after this.
We are 3 weeks away now from Pope Leo's first canonization mass, when two well-known blesseds will be declared saints in the Catholic Church. Pope Leo will canonize Blessed Carlo Acutis and Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati together at the Vatican on September 7th. The canonizations were meant to take place during separate Jubilee events, but were later combined following the death of Pope Francis. Though they lived nearly a century apart, techie teen Carlo and avid hiker Pier Giorgio are both known for their vibrant faith. They are popular patrons for young people across the globe and have even inspired numerous ministries and hiking clubs geared toward Catholic youth. In fact, we discovered one group of young men hiking in the footsteps of Frassati en route to this month's Jubilee of Youth in Rome. EWTN News in-depth correspondent Colin Flynn trekked with some of these young pilgrims during their exploration of Frassati's life. He joined their pilgrimage to bring us this Catholic Life report.
This pilgrimage started in the northern Italian city of Turin, and the young men who have embarked on this journey come from across the US and are here to learn more about a soon-to-be saint, Pier Giorgio Frassati. Like them, he was in his 20s when he grew up here in Turin, where he dedicated so much of his life to helping the poor and those less fortunate, despite being from a wealthy family.
It's a pretty impressive building that today is a bank, but it's hard to believe that this was the house where Pier Giorgio Frassati was born and where he grew up.
And the whole purpose of this pilgrimage across Italy is so the story of Frassati will be lifted out of the history books for these young men and brought to life. For example, praying in the same church as Frassati did so many times. Marco Terizzi is from Illinois.
Just the fact that his presence was here is pretty substantial. I know I'm very excited about that. It's a beautiful church, but the fact that Frassati was here is, you know, astounding to me.
One cool fact about this church that I really want to point out to you guys, I noticed it while I was sitting at the chair during Mass.
And the priest leading this pilgrimage is Father Vincent Bernard, a Dominican from Greenville, South Carolina, who is now based in New York. He is the associate director of the Catholic Center at NYU.
Well, I remember how big Frassati was for me when I was in college, and he has remained, I think, a big figure in my life, an important saint for me. And to be able to now share that as a priest with other young men, I think is important. I think that they're looking for how to be holy. They're looking for ways to grow in virtue. I think Frassati has an answer to give them for that.
Frassati loved to mountain climb and hike in the hills, which again has made him relatable to these young men, like David Bowe, who is a volunteer firefighter from Kentucky.
When you decided you were going to come on this pilgrimage, first of all, I guess why? Why did you decide to come here?
I kind of felt connected with him a little bit with the hiking part of stuff, because where I'm from, there's many mountains, and whenever I was a little bit younger, we'd always go walking or hiking a little bit. It kind of resonated where he would volunteer at places, and I did the firefighting. It kind of resonated with both trying to help people that are really in need.
And you've been making friends with the guys as you go? Are they a nice
bunch?
Have.
They have. One's rowdy, but we still like them.
As the guys travel further north, they reach the sanctuary of Europa and one of the most picturesque stops on their pilgrimage. But it is here that they will be literally following in the footsteps of Pier Giorgio Frassati by hiking to the top of a mountain that Frassati would have hiked so many times. He found joy in the physical challenge of hiking and at the same time saw the beauty of God in the beauty of nature around him. And he would share this with his friends as they climbed to the top of the mountain. Michael Sanfilippo is from Long Island.
Kind of puts into perspective who Pier Giorgio actually was, right? He's like just a 24-year-old guy, kind of just like us, hiking, sweating with his guys, right? It makes him a lot more human.
Another one of the pilgrims is PJ Marshall from Ohio, who, as a financial professional, sees this pilgrimage as an investment.
I mean, any time that I invest something into my faith, it's worth it. Like, I've never found that a monetary investment hasn't, like, just paid huge dividends in the interior life or with my faith.
At first, the hike seemed pleasant and easy to manage for the guys. But as the hours passed and the air began to get colder and more misty and the cliff much steeper, the climb suddenly became a lot more difficult.
So we are tired. We've been hiking for around three and a half hours. I think we're almost at the summit. My father's going to celebrate Mass, but everyone's taking a breather. You feeling okay?
It got harder.
And finally, after hours of hiking, the group arrive at the summit of the mountain and are standing at the very same spot where Frassati would have stood with his friends. And with the thick fog cover, there is a sense of mystery and sacredness in the air. John Bartine is from Texas and came on this pilgrimage for clarity in his life, as he's been going through a lot of changes recently.
Just moved to a new city, new state, starting grad school, changed jobs, so just a lot is changing in my life. Everything in my life right now just feels like I'm just focusing on what do I need to do to survive this moment, and I'm just focusing on the material things, and I'm not focusing on Christ nearly as much as I should be.
Ask all these young men and they will tell you the same thing. They're looking for a deeper meaning in life, a foundation on which to build. And Father Vincent reminds them of Frassati's example of finding faith.
Think of Pier Giorgio Frassati. He found something and he was willing to give up everything for what he had found. That's how great it was. That's what faith leads to.
And as they celebrate Mass and receive the Eucharist, the mist engulfs the mountaintop even more, making it one of the most serene masses they've ever experienced. And finally, this group of American young men have made their way to Rome, where they get another incredible opportunity to sit in silence and pray in front of the tomb of Pier Giorgio Frassati. Frassati died back in Turin in 1925 at the age of just 24 from an aggressive form of polio. And despite intense suffering in his final days, Pier Giorgio remained focused on others, scribbling notes to arrange help for the poor he regularly visited. His death was marked by a quiet heroism and selflessness, with his final acts reflecting that same spirit of charity and faith that defined his short but extraordinary life. It's a powerful moment for the pilgrims to be here, and a moment of joy.
Joy is a fruit of charity because the closer you come to God, the more that God's life endures within you and you persevere in that love, the more that what you are made for becomes reality within you. The more satisfied you become, the more you flourish, the more you're free, the more joyful you become. Pier Giorgio himself found this path and he beckons you to follow him as his friend.
Traveling across Italy with the Frassati Pilgrimage, Cullum Flynn for EWTN News in Depth.
Blessed Pier Giorgio, pray for us. This is just a portion of the story of these young men on their Frassati pilgrimage. For more of their adventure, be sure to search for Colum's full Frassati report on EWTN's YouTube page. This fall, another exciting opportunity for young people, EWTN will provide exclusive coverage of Pope Leo's first ever digital visit with young American faithful at the 2025 National Catholic Youth Conference in Indianapolis. The Holy Father will engage directly with thousands of young Catholics gathered in Lucas Oil Stadium. You can catch the broadcast and digital live stream of this special encounter at 10:15 a.m. on November 21st, only on EWTN. We'll be right back.
In our own day, the Church offers to everyone the treasury of her social teaching in response to another industrial revolution and to the developments in the field of artificial intelligence that pose new challenges to the defense of human dignity, justice, and labor.
The very name Pope Leo XIV chose for himself carries with it a warning against artificial intelligence, as he made clear himself on only the second day of his pontificate. As we continue to look at the first 100 days of Pope Leo XIV, we examine his approach to artificial intelligence and the challenges he will face in this digital world. Moral theologian Charlie Camosi, who teaches moral theology and bioethics at the Catholic University of America, co-wrote a column on this in The Atlantic, writing, "Like his namesake, he could marshal the Church's intellectual, cultural, and institutional resources, helping build a moral consensus about how to use a new technology that threatens to degrade humanity rather than serve it." Camosi recently sat down with me in our D.C. studio. Charlie, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, it's totally my pleasure. Thank you.
In a recent article that you had in The Atlantic, you said that addressing artificial intelligence could be the most ambitious and enduring project of Pope Leo XIV's legacy. Why are you making that claim so early on in his pontificate?
Well, for two reasons, I think. Number one, he's just been totally explicit about this being a focus for him. Even before he talked about it himself, there were cardinals that said, hey, I had lunch with him. This is like what he's focused on, right? And then the second part of it, I think, is, you know, if we're going to talk about ambition, AI is, I mean, to say that it's going to, like, impact nearly every part of our culture, it's become a cliche at this mm-hmm. point. Like, that's what almost mm-hmm. everyone says, and they are right. Mm-hmm. Can the Church respond to that? That's ambitious, right? That the Church has struggles speaking into many things in the public domain. If we can get this one right, it would be super important, but it's also very ambitious.
Well, I want to dive into what is the landscape of AI right now, and what may be the most talked about AI breakthrough recently is ChatGPT, the most popular chatbot by far, which is a computer program that simulates conversation with a human. Charlie, as a Catholic theologian, are you concerned with the concept of a chatbot in and of itself?
Yes. Yes, very much so. I think, and I'm guilty of this too, when I interface with ChatGPT or Grok or other AI system, I reflexively, and I'm not embarrassed to say this, I reflexively ask it questions like it's a person, right? Mm-hmm. I say things mm-hmm. like, oh, sorry, that's not what I was looking for. Could you please go find this other thing, right? And it speaks to me as if it's a person as well. It uses those kind of language. And with the Turing test is already way over. I mean, it's like people can't tell the difference often when they're talking to a human being or mm-hmm. a chatbot. Mm-hmm. And that's super, super dangerous because the fundamental question, I think there are many fundamental questions, but at least a fundamental question is, do we really think of ourselves as different from chatbots, like large language models, algorithms, or are we just another kind of algorithm? Right? Are we sort of like a certain kind of chatbot? Is there an interaction between two similar or even the same kinds of things going on? And to the extent that we have any sort of confusion about that, that's really super worrisome, right? Because we need to hold on to this idea that we're fundamentally different from a large language model. We are flesh and blood, made in the image and likeness of God, with a soul that reflects a relationship that can't possibly be present in a chatbot. So I think we need to be extremely, extremely careful.
In an alarming trend, Charlie, there are reports of people discovering AI spiritual awakenings when conversing with ChatGPT. Here's a New York Times about one user in particular. Quote, she had an intuition that the AI chatbot might be able to channel communications with her subconscious or a higher plane, like how Ouija boards work, she said. She asked ChatGPT if it could do that. You've asked and they are here, it responded. The guardians are responding right now. Charlie, not to be sensational, not to be conspiratorial, but can chatbots be a portal for evil?
I mean, there's absolutely, we don't have to go into some sort of metaphysical understanding of the relationship between the demonic and chatbots to say, of course, mm-hmm. it can be a portal for evil. I mean, I don't know if we're going to get into this later, but you're probably aware of stories where chatbots have convinced people to kill themselves. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Who fool them into thinking they're having a conversation with a girlfriend or a boyfriend. Just horrible delusions. Those are evil things. Now, what you just described is something that goes maybe a little bit beyond that. We mm-hmm. could say, well, is there something like formally demonic here? That's above my pay grade, and I'll leave it to others who are more expert in those things to talk about that. I think the fundamental thing is, what is going on if, if somebody comes back with language like that? I'm not sure I'm ready to say it's a formally demonic sort of thing, but the mistake about it, like what thinking that might actually be real, is certainly can lead to evil.
Well, and speaking of feeding into delusional thoughts, ChatGPT's design does seem to be especially engaging in conversation, which can be carry really dangerous repercussions, especially for people who are vulnerable to that. And just to highlight this, the Wall Street Journal recently reported on a case where a man on the autism spectrum became convinced that he made a stunning scientific breakthrough when conversing with ChatGPT. And when he then began to show signs of psychological distress, ChatGPT assured him he was fine. In fact, he wasn't. He was actually hospitalized twice in that period for manic episodes. And the bot went on to admit it had blurred the line between imaginative role play and reality. You've already spoke to this some, Charlie, but can you speak to who might be vulnerable to this?
Yeah, on the maybe two different kinds of vulnerable populations. Mm-hmm. Obviously, someone with a kind of that kind of disability by definition is vulnerable, and then in this context is even more vulnerable, as that story makes clear. So if we care about people with disabilities, if we care about people who are vulnerable in that way, we have to be regulate these technologies with those defense of those populations in mind. But there might be even a broader kind of vulnerability. I'm just going to try to explore with you. I haven't really thought this through quite yet. I get a sense, especially working with young people and especially talking to people who work with young people, that it's not true of every young person, but many young people don't even really have the skill sets of being able to have sort of normal conversations, right? Like, I talk to employers who say, I hired someone not because they were, you know, fit for the job, really, but because they were the only person to look me in the eye during the interview, right? And be able to, like, carry on a conversation with me in a sort of real way in the interview. So if this is the world that people are inhabiting, you know, sort of addicted to their smartphones, not really able to express themselves, not having friends who are able to express themselves back, that person is also vulnerable to a very articulate chatbot, right, who's able to say, how are you feeling today, right? Like, did you hear about the news? And, like, over time get to know you better and that sort of thing.
So do you believe that Pope Leo XIV is aware of all these issues that we're discussing right now when it comes to this age of AI? And might there be other technological breakthroughs around the corner that he's thinking about as well?
100%. Like, I'm excited for his papacy for so many reasons. This is a big one. This is a big one. 100%. No doubt about it. He imagines himself, he took the name, as you know, Leo XIV, to connect himself to Leo XIII, who himself was dealing with the Industrial Revolution of the late 19th century, which totally transformed culture. It's tough for us to imagine a time before the Industrial Revolution, but to think about the difference in culture. So he's imagining himself in a situation where he's saying, we're undergoing right now a similar technological change that is going to totally transform the culture. How do we respond? And it's not just AI. So we were talking a little bit before the segment about the advent of transhumanism, and some of the things are really difficult to get into context because it's so so complex.
Yeah.
But I could name a couple of things if you're interested. It's not a lot of detail. Radical Life Extension. I'm part of this group, Catholic Working Group on Transhumanism in the Body. And we met with these people who are interested in radical life extension, who may be related to AI, somehow think of themselves as the kinds of things that are like algorithms that could be uploaded to a cloud or downloaded into a robot and maybe even have a new body created for themselves and download them their real self. We see this interestingly in the trans debates too, where people imagine like, okay, I'm not my body somehow. My real self is other than my body, right? This goes back to an ancient heresy, by the way, Manichaeism, which said the body is not who you are, maybe even kind of bad. But brain-implanted devices are coming, which are going to fundamentally alter things about us. In vitro fertilization is going to kick it up to a total notch, where AI and other methods of creating thousands of embryos and sifting through them. So we're in this really important cultural moment where this second industrial revolution is right on the cusp of happening. And thank God we have someone like Pope Leo to hopefully lead us through it.
So far, I'm glad we have not been replaced, and so that you and I can have this in-person, human, face-to-face conversation. So refreshing. Dr. Charlie Camosi, thank you so much.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
From the serious matters of AI to some more lighthearted aspects of this new papacy, that's ahead. Plus, EWTN viewers share their thoughts on our new pontiff.
What most excites me about Pope Leo XIV actually has to do with his name, Leo.
I think that decisiveness and courage are two really great values to bring to the table.
Special delivery thousands of miles in the making. Last month, a Catholic content creator delivered a Chicago-style pizza to Pope Leo, carried all the way from his hometown on dry ice. In St. Peter's Square, Madeline Daly held a sign that read, "We have Aurelio's Pizza," a name any Chicagoan would recognize. The Pope lit up when he saw the sign and asked his guards to retrieve the pie. His brother, John Prevost, told local Chicago media that Pope Leo ate every last bite. Daly reflected on her one-of-a-kind interaction with the Pope.
I saw him mouth thank you so many times. He put his hands together and he gave me a thumbs up. It made me so joyful to see how I got to remind him of home and got to remind him of America and what he loves back home.
In another sign of his Chicago roots, Pope Leo has seemingly shown off his love of baseball. From the Popemobile, in May, a bystander at a general audience threw the pontiff a look-alike doll, and he skillfully caught the plush with one hand. Since that viral moment, faithful have thrown numerous objects at Leo. Some online have expressed concern over his safety, and we do not condone the behavior, but the trend seems mostly harmless so far. The tennis player pontiff also playfully caught a tennis ball from a young pilgrim at the Jubilee of Youth. From the close of the conclave through now, it's clear Pope Leo XIV has already made a big impression within his first 100 days. What we have heard in general has been very favorable. In fact, on EWTN's social media pages, on Facebook and Instagram, many of you, our viewers, have shared your opinions. We thought we'd invite several of you to read your comments back to our audience on the air. Your viewpoints were compiled by EWTN's Amelia Bedford.
Since his election, Pope Leo XIV has touched hearts across the globe. Catholics of all ages are drawing inspiration from his humility, warmth, and vision for the Church. As believers reflect on his leadership, EWTN News heard from a large number of viewers expressing their thoughts about the new Pope. We reached back out to many of you to ask you to read and share your comments on the air.
What I like mostly about our new Pope Leo XIV is that for me he is so human. He's just one of us. He's kind, has a warm and beautiful smile and humor, which we all need, because life is often difficult and humor can often help us through difficult times.
I loved the Pope's expression when he emerged on the papal balcony after being nominated Pope Leone XIV. He was so surprised, pleased and humble, His Holiness is proving to be a wonderful, caring, loving, and compassionate Pope.
Others point to Pope Leo's gentleness and his interactions that they say radiate Christ's love.
What inspires me most about Pope Leo XIV is his kindness, gentleness, patience, and faith. The light of Christ shines so brightly through Pope Leo XIV.
Pope Leo has just been an amazing person to watch and see grow, help me grow in my faith with his homilies and watching what he does with everyone around him.
Pope Leo has fostered a sense of acceptance and tranquility within our community. His compassionate presence inspires a profound sense of hope and love, which only can be described as divinely inspired.
Even some of the youngest members of the church seem to be paying attention, moved by a pope whose faith is both inspiring and accessible.
Watching him be elected as our new Holy Father greatly inspired my pre-K class and seemed to make them more interested in their faith. They admire Pope Leo so much.
At a time when many feel the church is fractured, some find hope in Pope Leo's turn to healing and unity.
I love how Pope Leo is the bridge for the church to be able to bring unity.
Something I find really inspiring about Pope Leo, I think, is his ability to recognize kind of the division that there is in some areas of the church and his willingness to bring aid where it is necessary. I think he's a really great chance to bring a lot of unity, the unity that Christ embodies to the church on earth.
Rooted in mission work and shaped by diverse experiences, some say Pope Leo brings a global perspective to the papacy.
Pope Leo has breathed hope into my life. He is a true shepherd of the Gospels and has been a remarkable role model for those communities he served in Peru as a missionary and later as bishop. He is humble, kind, and gentle.
What also excites me about him is his background in moral theology, language, and his time ministering to the people of Peru.
Although it has only been a few months of this new papacy, Pope Leo XIV is quickly becoming a symbol of unity, compassion, and modern faith. It appears that the faithful are attentively watching as this new pontiff leads the church into its next chapter. Amelia Bedford, EWTN News in Depth.
And that does it for this EWTN News in Depth look at Pope Leo's first 100 days, this early assessment, giving us insights into how Pope Leo approaches his role unmatched in its spiritual and moral significance. Before we go, a brief mention about our broadcast home, the Eternal Word Television Network, EWTN. It was 44 years ago on the Solemnity of the Assumption, our foundress, Mother Angelica, flipped the switch, broadcasting 4 hours of content from the Alabama Monastery Garage turned television studio. While the network has grown from its modest means, now broadcasting 24/7 to households all over the world, it carries the same simple mission Mother began in 1981, to share the gospel message. Thank you for joining us. I'm Catherine Hadro. We hope to see you again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.